Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. There's a great leap forward going on in molecular biology. Scientists have figured out that our genes are chock full of ancient deadly viruses that once tried to wipe us out. Most do nothing, but some are still active and even play a vital role in keeping us alive. And now, in search of a cure for AIDS, scientists are bringing dead ones back to life. This hour, On Point, the wild new science of paleovirology and the long symbiosis of man and virus. Joining me this hour from London is Michael Spector. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and his amazing story in this week's issue is titled Darwin's Surprise. Michael, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Your article is fascinating, and I wonder, for the purposes of our conversation, if you'd set the table for us and give us a working definition, if you will, of a virus. What is it?
A virus is an unbelievably simple thing. It's just an infectious agent that can't really grow or reproduce unless it's in another cell. It's a bunch of DNA wrapped in protein or fat, and that's all it is. It's so simple that most scientists don't actually consider viruses to be alive.
And when that virus takes control of another cell's machinery, cellular machinery, if you will, it soon infects it, and then that cell becomes millions and billions of other cells.
Yeah, then it becomes less simple. Once it gets into a cell, it has this one unbelievably cool talent, which is it can take over the cellular machinery of a place it infects. And then it just reproduces, 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 and each of those cells reproduce. And literally, one cell can become billions and trillions rather rapidly. And that is why viral diseases are so dangerous.
All right, so let's begin with these viral diseases. Explain the fact that fossilized viruses, if you will, are actually in our genes. How so?
Yeah, it's kind of a counterintuitive and surprising thing for those of us who are not molecular biologists, and that would include me. Mm-hmm. For hundreds of millions of years, viruses have been on the Earth, and we've been on the Earth, and they've been infecting us, and there's been this sort of battle between viruses and the cells they infect. It's a very strictly, clearly Darwinian thing, and viruses will evolve in such a way that they can defeat the cells. The cells will evolve in such a way that they develop antiviral proteins that defeat and change the viruses. And some viruses continue to be quite devastating to us, but there are many viruses that once upon a time, a million years ago, 5 million years ago, a few hundred thousand years ago, were quite deadly, but broke down. And what happens over evolution is usually viruses tend to get weaker and less dangerous. And quite a few of them are easy to find in the genome of the human being.
So they broke down, but they're still in us. So are they alive inside us or just dead matter?
No, it's a little complicated because there are these things called retroviruses, which we mostly know about because the AIDS virus is one. And retroviruses are the opposite of other viruses in that most viruses take DNA and then they send out this RNA, which is kind of like a little messenger. Mm-hmm. And the RNA tells the cell what to do and the cell does it. With retroviruses, it's the RNA that does it. And the thing about that is it allows them to tell the DNA to insert itself into the actual DNA of your cell. And once something's in your DNA, it's like a gene. So if you've got it in your cells and you have a baby, the baby's going to have it in its cells. Mm-hmm. And if you are a chimpanzee who evolves into a human, you can go back and look at the chimpanzee, and sure enough, the same virus will be in the same place on those cells. And over the hundreds of thousands of years, those viruses have become less dangerous to us. They've been broken down. They've been defeated. They're not pathogenic, but they're still easy to find.
In fact, some of them are crucial to us. Without viruses, mammals probably would never have developed a placenta, right? During the birth.
It's a controversial field, and it's a quasi new field, especially given what people are learning rapidly these days. But one of the central beliefs of many people is that the placenta, in fact, is it shares a key protein with some of these retroviruses. And the placenta, when you think about it, it's kind of like a virus. I mean, what does it do? It attaches on to the womb. It's a parasite. And it evolved away from being an egg so that it could attach itself to the mother, and with amazing benefits for mammals, which we probably, for the last few hundred thousand years, take it for granted. But allowing us to have live birth, allowing the mother to run around so that she's not hunted by when she's sitting on an egg. And it has made it possible for mammals to develop big brains. Now, it turns out that placental, some of the key placental proteins are really the same proteins that you find in these type of retroviruses, which they call endogenous retroviruses, which is a big term, but it just means they're in there for good.
Hmm. You quote a scientist in the piece that says, who says, there's more virus in us than there is us in us. Why is that significant?
Well, I think the point is just that we think of viruses as sort of the definitive foreign things. You know, you get a virus, you get sick, you either take drugs, you get better. But in fact, they're not just evil. They're part of us. And they may have helped us evolve in a way that has made us useful and human in the way that we understand those words.
Nothing has posed a more persistent threat to humans than viruses over time. And so when I hear you say that, I hear things, you know, yellow fever and measles and smallpox. Yet you say in your article that their impact was limited by their ferocity. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's actually kind of simple. If a virus kills you, then it can't hang out and kill anyone else. I mean, when it enters a cell, if it doesn't adapt to that cell and figure out a way to continue to survive, then it's going to be no good anymore. It's just going to die when you die. And so smallpox is awesomely deadly and has killed an untold number of people. It's not in our DNA. We don't pass it down. So the worst it can do is wipe out whoever it infects, and that's pretty bad. But it doesn't actually change us as genetic human beings.
So can anything reactivate a virus then that's inside us, bring it back to life, if you will, inside our bodies and infect us again?
Yeah, I guess the answer to that is yes, but if you're talking about these ancient broken down retroviruses, it's sort of unclear that that could happen. And one of the things you have to remember is that this evolution has taken place over millions of years. I mean, some of these viruses entered our genome 5 million years ago, and they're very broken down. So nothing could get into our system, reactivate it, put it together, splice it so it works and make us sick. I mean, that's a process that takes trillions of years. But that doesn't mean that things don't get in and that you see some reaction to invaders through parts of these broken down retroviruses. And proteins are created. Sometimes there's a feeling that maybe these things actually protect us from infections that are worse.
So how is it that a scientist now, based on what your article tells us, and with all this as a backdrop, take a virus that has been extinct for hundreds of thousands of years and bring it back to life? What would be the point of doing that?
Well, there are a couple points. One is intellectual evolutionary history. I mean, if you can put it back together, you can figure out how it evolved, and you can look back in time and see how it changed. Something much more interesting to me, and I think more valuable, is that retroviruses have particular characteristics, and a lot of them have changed, but a lot have not. They're not that different in some ways from HIV, which is a retrovirus that is killing lots of us and that we've tried really hard to prevent. It's very difficult to develop a vaccine. There's almost no serious medical center in the world that isn't trying. And there's a feeling that if you can look at how these viruses evolved, see how they changed and were, in fact, defeated by evolution, you may be able to use that insight and even some of the aspects of its evolution to defeat the virus that's killing us now.
So we shouldn't fear this sort of breakthrough, this sort of bringing back of these old viruses. We should celebrate it? Or is it both?
Well, I mean, look, I think it's not that simple, because once you bring something back to life that didn't function for a few hundred thousand years, that's just intuitively a scary thing, and it does raise questions. Now, these particular viruses are not that infectious. When they infect you, when HIV infects you, it's bad. But they're not that easy. You don't get infected that easily. You don't get it from a sneeze or a cough. So these particular viruses aren't brutally dangerous. And the people that I wrote about in my story were quite careful to reconstruct them in such a way so that they could only produce once and no more than once. Nonetheless, yeah, it's a little scary. And there are other viruses that could be brought back to life that would be quite dangerous and easy to make. I mean, we're entering a field of life where we're going to be making synthetic forms of life. And anyone who thinks that we're not is living in a world that no longer exists.
Essentially, anyone can assemble a virus, if you will, with ease. You mentioned in your piece some students who built a polio virus using DNA they bought through the mail.
No, what I said was, it's not anyone. I mean, you have to have some skills. For instance, I could not go home tonight and whip up a little polio virus. But these guys who put it together were quite sophisticated, in fact. And they understood the sequencing of the genome, and they knew how to put the parts together. And there are lots of people like that in lots of places. I mean, it's not the average person who can, but there are many, many people who can.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the burgeoning field in molecular biology called paleovirology and the new discoveries being made, some even in the last week, about viruses and animals. I've been speaking with Michael Spector, a writer for The New Yorker magazine, who has a fascinating story about all this in the current issue. And I'd like to bring in another voice into the conversation. Now, from Dallas, Texas, Dr. John Coffin. He's a professor of molecular and microbiology at Tufts University. He was also one of the first to explore the role of retroviruses in human evolution. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Coffin. Thanks.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this new field, this new world of viruses and human life.
Well, we've known for in many species, such as mice and chickens, for quite some time that there are these endogenous viruses that Michael was talking about earlier in the genome, and that they could, under some conditions, be resurrected. In humans, it's only very recently that we have come to have a full appreciation of the very large numbers of these things, and only within the last few months that it has been appreciated that, in fact, in humans, that these viruses could, in fact, be resurrected through manipulations in the laboratory.
And so from a scientific perspective, why is it, to your mind, so important to do that?
Well, we're also becoming aware not only that these viruses are present, but that they provide us with a fossil record of how viruses and humans and our ancestors have all evolved together. There's been this remarkable evolutionary arms race between viruses and us and our ancestors, and having these viruses and being able to study them will shed more light on exactly these effects, and that may understanding how we've naturally been able, or other species have naturally been able, to shake off virus infections in the past may well provide us with very important clues as to how we can do that deliberately in the future to treat particularly HIV and other retrovirus infections.
Well, go into that a little bit more. Broadly speaking, the therapeutic implications of this breakthrough, as you mentioned, HIV and AIDS.
Well, one good example is there's a gene that's been recently discovered in humans and other primates and in monkeys that can block HIV infection. And in humans, this gene doesn't work very well for that purpose, and that's one reason why we get infected by HIV, and perhaps one reason why some other monkey species do not. It's a group in Washington has recently discovered that the reason this gene doesn't work very well in humans is one one small change in it, and that change was apparently driven by to create resistance to a different retrovirus, and by becoming resistant to that retrovirus, it actually made our ancestors more susceptible to HIV. So understanding these processes, and there are probably many more examples of this waiting to be discovered as we develop the tools to be able to do so, and these resurrected viruses are one of these tools that will be very important for these kinds.
So take us through this, Dr. Coffin, and explain to us exactly how you bring these viruses back to life. What's the process of piecing it together and doing that?
Well, it's a matter of taking advantage of the fact that there are a number of these. There are about a dozen of this particular type of virus in our DNA, and all of them have been damaged a little bit. But they've been damaged in different ways. It's like taking a car, two damaged cars, one with a bad engine and one with bad brakes, taking the pieces out of one and putting it into the other and making a good car again, and that's essentially the process that was done here. The people that did this, not us, but some other groups, have studied these the genetic structure of these viruses and taken a sequence and created a genetic structure in the lab that has pieces from one and pieces from another that are predicted to be what the original ancestor looked like.
And so then was this virus then put into a human cell?
The virus was then put into a human cell.
And then what happened?
And that cell then made, was the DNA from the virus properly that was put into a cell. And that cell then produced more virus, and that virus could then be shown to infect another human cell, meaning that, in fact, these two groups had successfully resurrected a virus that was, if not identical to, at least close enough to the original ancestor to be able to function properly.
Interesting. We have some really good questions from callers, so I'd like to go to the phones now. First to Spokane, Washington, and Michael, who is there. Hi. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Jane. Just a quick question. How do you tell when a virus is extinct? It seems to me like they mutate so quickly, like a flu will come through one year, the population gets over it, and then there's another flu the next year. So how do you tell?
Good question. Dr. Coffin, you want to take that first?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And the answer is you tell the same way you tell an animal is extinct. That is to say, you can't find a live one that looks like it anymore. You might be wrong. It's like the ivory-billed woodpecker. Perhaps there are some around that are still functional. In fact, some of the research in my own laboratory is aimed at looking to see if perhaps there are some very rare members of this that are still alive that we just haven't spotted yet.
Michael Spector, take us back to the human genome when it was fully mapped in 2003 and explain to us how all of this was discovered in the first place, would you?
Well, I think that scientists working on this, Dr. Coffin being one, had anticipated that we would find defeated bits of virus in our body. I think what was surprising was how much of it there was, because it turns out that 8% of our genome consists of these endogenous retroviruses. Only 2% of our genome consists of the genes we need to make proteins to keep us alive. So the idea that, and again, this is, I think, actually Dr. Coffin who said this to me, but that's why there are more viruses in us than us, because there's four times as many of the viral genes than there are of the genes that we normally think of as doing our job.
And these viruses have often been referred to, I think, and you said in your piece, as junk DNA, when in fact they have played a major role in our evolution.
Yeah, I think that the junk DNA thing, I think people in the field don't use it very much anymore, and it refers to those viruses and also lots of other elements of DNA that jump around, and for which there was never a really clear function, but I think most people feel that, you know, every week, every month, we're learning new things. Even this story, which was originally something I thought would be about evolutionary history that ended a few hundred thousand years ago, They're finding things out almost every month about that. So I do think that it's unlikely. I think we'll eventually find out that much of the DNA that we don't think has a purpose or don't get the purpose, we will one day figure out what it's doing there.
I'll go back to the lines now in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Denise, who's calling. Hi, welcome, Denise, to you.
Thank you, Jane, for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I think this is fascinating science, and I think that it's really important that we engage in these kinds of activities. I worry, however, in this age of bioterrorism and the ability for people who with not good means to combine viruses or to use these kinds of things as weapons against us, what kinds of protocols could be put in place or what kinds of safeguards you're using in doing these experiments to make sure that some of these ancient viruses that may be killers aren't used against us? Is there anything that could be done?
Good question, Denise. Thanks. Dr. Coffin, do you want to start?
Well, at the moment, there's no reason to believe that any of these are sufficiently infectious to be very high on a potential terror's to-do list, as it were. There are many other agents that we know about that are much more amenable for that purpose, should one be disposed to do so. The retroviruses, as a rule, are very bad agents for bioterror as we know them today because, as was pointed out, they are not transmitted through air or water or any other sort of casual contact means. They all require very close transmission, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that these viruses that are being resurrected would be any different. We have lots of experience with very large numbers of different retroviruses.
Michael Spector,
in
your reporting, Michael Spector, did you find it possible that these viruses could be used in a sinister way?
Well, first of all, for me to disagree with Dr. Coffin on this is sort of like a little leaguer trying to bat against Alex Rodriguez. But, it's technically possible, but he's right. To be quite honest, if you want to be a bioterrorist and kill people with the virus, well, smallpox and polio are much more efficient and excellent ways to do that. The only thing retroviruses do that they don't is if you were to infect someone with a retrovirus, it's an infection that's going to infect your species. Having said that, it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to manipulate. They're weakly infectious. And I agree. I don't think they're in the top 10. I never really thought of a terrorist to-do list. But, yeah, I would say they're not way up there.
Back to Newton, Massachusetts now, and Adam, who's on the line. Adam, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello. I am calling because I've learned that viruses contain double-stranded RNA and animal cells do not, right? We have double-stranded DNA and single-stranded RNA. I'm not a virologist, so I'm curious about its role in the virus and that is of double-stranded RNA. And I'm also curious in part because a friend of mine has developed a molecular way of linking double-stranded RNA with cell death mechanisms. So you talked about earlier a virus that is too destructive will eventually die out. Well, if a virus can be linked to cell death, then it can't replicate. So I'm wondering first, what is the role of double-stranded RNA, and second, can it play a role in a cure?
A bit of a technical question. Adam, thank you. I'll turn that to Dr. Coffin for a response.
Yeah, there's several questions in there.
Yeah.
First, double-stranded RNA is found in some viruses, but not retroviruses. Double-stranded RNA is not a property of retroviruses. Second, viruses that do use double-stranded RNA will induce in cells. There's a potent antiviral mechanism that all cells have that recognizes double-stranded RNA as being something that doesn't belong there and actually eventually leads to the death of that cell before that cell can make more virus. Obviously, viruses that operate this way have also found ways to defeat this mechanism. This is part of the virus-human arms race, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But viruses that kill cells this way still manage to make have the cell make enough of themselves to go on and infect other cells before they die, or else they would, in fact, die out.
I wanted to ask you about this, the phrase that you just used and that was used earlier in this conversation in the article by Michael Spector, this arms race, the evolutionary arms race. Will we always be in balance in this race, or could one side technically take a turn and upend us?
It can go either way. Clearly, many of these retroviruses that we see as in our DNA have almost certainly become extinct. Obviously, as I said before, you can never be 100% sure of that, but you can be 99.99% sure. And that is probably a result of success on our part for the arms race. On the other hand, it's large populations have been wiped out by virus infections. And in that sense, the virus is in some way winning the arms race. Although for the virus to win the arms race is not such a good thing, because if it really wins, then the virus is without anybody to infect anymore and itself dies out.
I want to get one more call in before we go to the break. Margaret is on the line now from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. And hi to your wonderful medical scholar. I told your screener that I teach theology in the Boston area, and your guest has answered a long-standing theological question for which I am so grateful. And the question is, according to the account in Genesis, everything God created was good. And so the question always arose, why are these viruses evil? If there's something within the creation, why are they, you know, kind of wreaking havoc? And so now your guest has explained that they had a positive function.
Thank you, Margaret.
I'm so grateful.
Well, thanks. Michael Spector, do you want to respond to that?
I do, but I don't think we have the 17 hours that would be necessary. I would just
I've got 2 minutes.
Actually,
go ahead.
I don't subscribe to the God created everything good theory. I think viruses are unbelievably interesting because, like the rest of evolution, they're in some sort of counterbalance, and we're seeing change over millions of years. To call them good or bad, I don't do that, because who's to say what's good or bad when you're looking at a protein? I mean, they're just things that evolve. So I don't like to anthropomorphize things that have existed for millions or tens of millions of years.
Let's go to one more call before our break. Richard is on the line from Essex, Massachusetts. Richard, go ahead. Hi.
My question was, are viruses like other beings that size, are they living beings, or are they something totally other?
All right, Richard, thanks. Dr. Coffin?
I do not consider viruses to be living things, and I think most virologists do not. A virus lacks, when it's not within a cell, a virus lacks most of the things that characterize living beings. It can't divide by itself. It can't do any of its own activities. It can't eat. It can't do anything that a living thing does. So I consider a virus to be a nicely packaged piece of information, in the same way that a computer virus is not a computer.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the new discoveries about viruses and how they live within the very genes of humans and other animals, and in fact have helped us evolve. My guests this hour are Dr. John Coffin, one of the country's most distinguished molecular biologists and a researcher at Tufts University, and Michael Spector, who is a staff writer for The New Yorker, whose story on paleovirology appears in this week's issue. Michael Spector, I'd like you to tell us a story from your article, an interesting one I thought, about how retroviruses seem to be evolving before our eyes in Australia. Tell us about the koalas and their evolution there.
Well, it's an interesting example, because one of the problems that researchers like Dr. Coffin have encountered is this evolution happens over millions of years, and you want to see how it works, but it's kind of hard to watch something unfold over 5 million years. In Australia, there's a retroviral infection that affects koalas, and it's very dangerous, and it threatens their species. As researchers looked at the DNA, they found a couple things. They found that they were endogenous retroviruses, meaning they were part of the species, and babies would get the infection from their mother, and it would appear in the same place in the genome. What's particularly interesting, and you would expect that, What's particularly interesting is that about 100 years ago, hunters almost hunted koalas to extinction on the mainland of Australia. So they took those remaining koalas and they spread them out on the barrier islands to the south, and then over time moved them back onto the island. And all the ones on the island show these infections. There's a place, on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
Kangaroo Island is one of the barrier islands. Those koalas have no infection whatsoever. They were never moved. They were isolated. And what this clearly shows is that this infection has been going on over the last 100 years, because it's only been during the last
right.
century that those animals were there. And 100 years in evolutionary times, pretty damn quick. So it gives scientists an opportunity to look and see how that's unfolding. And I think it will offer them lots of ways of testing their hypothesis about how these things unfolded in humans. Mm.
Interesting story. Thanks. Peter is on the line now from Silver City, New Mexico. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, Jane. I wanted to ask your guest about viruses and whether they could be the long-sought-after mechanism for mutation that evolution requires.
Okay. Dr. Coffin, what do you think?
I think viruses have played a small role in creating diversity and mutation. There are a number of examples. You mentioned the placenta and a few others where viruses have clearly had either positive or negative effects on because of where they happen to end up in the in our DNA. But I don't think there are many other mutational mechanisms as well that do not involve viruses that have also been important. So it's a part of the story, but it's by no means the whole story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Michael Spector, let me go back to you for a moment and have you tell us about this breakthrough that you reported in your piece in The New Yorker for the treatment of HIV-infected cells. Tell us about the so-called smart bombs, as you called them, that would hone in on the HIV virus in the body.
Well, this is relatively preliminary. The one thing I would be hesitant about calling it is a breakthrough, because that implies a therapy that's imminent, and I don't think we're there. But what the researchers did see was that with HIV infection, HIV alters cells in a number of ways. And one of the things they saw was that it induces endogenous retroviruses to give off certain signals, to generate certain proteins. It doesn't bring them back to life, but you can see some protein activity. And they sort of serve as kind of the Jonah to the HIV's whale. When they tested a bunch of HIV-infected people for these signals, this protein, they all had them. 15 out of 16 had them. When they tested a bunch of people who were not infected, they either had unbelievably weak signals or none at all. And so the idea there is, gee, this is a marker. This is a way that if we go after those cells, we can get the HIV. And it's because of the endogenous retroviruses that they can think about doing that. I mean, we're way far away from a vaccine, but it's just an incredibly intriguing new avenue to explore.
Interesting. Rachel now on the line from Williamsburg, Virginia, joining the conversation. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. Given that these viruses are already inside of our bodies, I was wondering if these would be a good mechanism for gene therapy.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Coffin?
Well, there is certainly a very large and active field of gene therapy that is using viruses very much like some of these to bring genes into individuals and to try to cure certain kinds of genetic diseases. And there have been some successes and there have been some failures and there have been some problems like any other developing area of therapy, but this is a very active field of research right now.
Now to Deep River, Connecticut, and Becky, who is on the line there. Hi, Becky. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a comment here.
Sure.
I understand the benefits of biotechnology in that I have been a molecular biologist for 25 years, but I'm very concerned about the disregard the present community, scientific community, is contributing or discussing regarding the safety of these viruses. These viruses can be very dangerous. They can be pseudotyped with BSDG. They can, shRNAs can be inserted into them. And these mechanisms, make them very dangerous. A VSG pseudotype can make an HIV virus infect in your eyes by ingestion and by inhalation. The problem with today is that there's no regulations, especially on private industry. There are regulations on academia through the NIH, but again, that is all in-house regulation. These viruses are being made, they're not being registered. In regard to terrorists, if I were a terrorist, which I'm not, but if I were a terrorist, I would think these viruses would be very, very beneficial. For example, you could make take an HIV virus, pseudotype it with VSVG, put it, place an shRNA in it, which an shRNA are molecular missiles that can basically destroy gene products, any gene product that a scientist wants to target.
Becky, I'm going to cut you off there, and I'm going to let Michael Spector respond.
Yeah, I have a non-scientific but philosophical response to this, which is we're in a world where these things can happen. I mean, if I was a terrorist, I wouldn't worry about this stuff. I'd make polio or I'd make smallpox. But the truth is you can make atom bombs. You can do bad things with science and technology. And you should regulate it. And I believe that it is regulated. And I even think in industry, you can always say that it's not accurately regulated. Nuclear energy exists. There are so many ways to destroy life on this planet that the idea that, gee, we now have a new way, I don't understand that thinking. I mean, I think we need to be careful, and I think we need to see what value it produces. But sure, there's dangers. There's dangers when you get in a car and you drive to the store. You can die, and you can kill people.
Dr. Coffin, what are your thoughts, scientifically speaking, about the safety of this?
First, I completely agree with Michael's philosophical points. Regarding the specific suggestion, to my knowledge, nobody has made a virus that actually can have VSVG in it and replicate more than once. So you can't get an infectious virus that's useful for anything in terms of infecting a whole organism as a VSVG pseudotype. Secondly, the shRNA, there are many, many things you could put into retroviruses. I'm not sure, even sure shRNA would be my first choice for this kind of thing. If you were trying to, in fact, I don't know, and I don't think any scientist knows how to make a virus that is capable of both causing disease and spreading to a greater extent than it was able to do so before you started. It's just too, at least right now, it's just too complicated a story. And I completely agree with Michael that if I were doing this kind of thing, if I were a terrorist, I would not even think about using retroviruses for this purpose.
Thanks, Dr. Coffin. Owen now in Cornwall, Ontario, Canada. Hi, Owen. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks.
Sure.
I'm just wondering why our bodies can store the information for, say, the chickenpox for the rest of our lives, but when we get the common cold, why can't our bodies store that kind of information and vaccinate us for life against a particular strand of the cold? That's all I'm wondering.
Owen, thanks. Dr. Coffin?
In fact, we do get vaccinated by common cold viruses, but the problem is there are many, many different strains which do not recognize the vaccine. That's a property that's different for different viruses. With poliovirus, there are only a few strains, for example, so we can get vaccinated against all of them. With a common cold, there are many, many different strains. And if you're vaccinated or protected or have been infected with one of them, you can still get infected with another one perfectly well.
Howard now is in Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Howard. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was wondering, has anybody documented the appearance of a brand new virus that hasn't previously existed, as opposed to discovering one that hasn't been previously known? And in the appearance of new viruses, about how many steps would be involved in a new virus being created, what might those steps be?
Michael Spector, I'll let you answer the first question, maybe Dr. Coffin the last.
Well, new viruses pop up all the time. I mean, you probably remember SARS a couple years ago. They often come from animals. They're called zoonoses. They go into humans. They infect us. They mutate in such a way that maybe they're dangerous, maybe they're not. Maybe they become extremely lethal. This is the problem with the flu. Certain forms of it can be unbelievably deadly, and they are new to the degree that you wouldn't have found the 1918 flu in 1827.
I think Howard's second question, Dr. Coffin, related to the steps of identifying a new virus.
I think also the steps by which they could arise.
Yeah.
But I should just add to the first that as far as we know, none of these viruses are new in the sense that they have just sort of appeared out of nothing. They have been around for very, very long times in some animal species, which serves then as a reservoir or another, and we just haven't seen it before. Two things. One is for a virus to appear new in the human population to be transmitted requires both the opportunity to transmit, but actually even more importantly, it requires that the virus be able to spread from one individual to another. And many infections, for example, Ebola, can arise in human populations, create very scary diseases by transmission from bats or some other species that they're wherever they're found. But then those infections have always died out because they're unable to be transmitted efficiently from mm-hmm. one person to another before the infected individual dies. To create a virus from sort of whole cloth, if you like, would require a very large number of steps. And I think that's an event that happens extraordinarily rarely, probably only a few times in the billion-year history of life on Earth have viruses appeared by being assembled from bits of genetic information in cells, for example.
Michael Spector, I want to turn back to you for a moment. I don't want to close this hour without you telling the story of the frustrating mystery that you reported in your article in The New Yorker, the study of chimpanzees who are easily infected by the AIDS virus, but it never makes them sick. Will you tell us that?
Well, it's a little bit, Dr. Coffin hit on it earlier. There's this virus that we have defeated long ago. It's got a weird name, PTERV. And it's a virus that can affect chimps. But the opposite is also true. If you infect HIV, if you infect a chimp with HIV, it'll get infected. It just won't get sick. So some of the researchers I talked to, these two guys, Michael Emmerman and Harmeet Malik up at the Hutchinson Institute, Fred Hutchinson Institute in Seattle, decided to play around with this version of the virus and see if the thing that offered protection to chimps might be altered so that it offers protection to humans. And what they found when they played around with it was that the virus would either protect you against HIV or it would protect you against the protein would either protect you against HIV or against this other virus that doesn't bother us anymore, but that bothers our genetic relatives. And so some little thing, maybe not a little thing, but probably a little thing, changed so that we were able to defeat those viruses. But as Dr. Coffin said earlier, the cost may have been that we're now susceptible to a disease that doesn't bother chimps. Mm.
In the last couple of minutes here, I wanted to just get your thoughts, Dr. Coffin, related to the technology here that's evolving so rapidly. Where is the study of these viruses going in the next few years?
Well, there are a lot of endogenous viruses, and I think we'll be able to do these kinds of things with more and more. And I predict that we will discover still more instances of natural host defenses against these viruses that have arisen over many millions of years as a part of this arms race, and that we'll be able to understand this much better. And it is certainly an expectation that this knowledge will lead us to think of better ways, newer and better ways to deal with present-day infections like HIV.
And Michael, from your perspective and all your reporting, where do you see this technology and this study going?
Well, I mean, it's amazing. I don't think that this could have been done at all 10 years ago. And I think right now, probably one of Dr. Coffin's smart graduate students could do it. And in 5 years, a college student, and in 10 years, who knows? But I think it's an endlessly open field. And I also think that it's, we haven't talked about it moving backwards, but I think it's going to give us a way of looking back on the history of our species, which is both fascinating and will also prove valuable.
Michael Spector, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His story, Darwin's Surprise, appears in the current issue of the magazine. Michael Spector, thanks.
Thank you.
And Dr. John Coffin, professor of molecular and microbiology at Tufts University. Appreciate your time and your expertise, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rowley, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.